This is Hacker Public Radio, episode 3022 for Tuesday, the 3rd of March, 2020. Today's show is entitled FOSDEM 2020 Stand Interviews. And is part of the series, Interviews. It is hosted by Ken Falun. And is about 93 minutes long. And carries a clean flag. The summary is, interviews with some of the stands at FOSDEM 2020.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by archive.org. Support universal access to all knowledge by heading over to archive.org/donate.
Hi everybody, after promising never to do this again, I'm back at FOSDEM interviewing people at the stands, because why not? And I'm here talking to...
Stanislas Dolcini. I'm one of the Wildfire Games team members working on the open source project Zero AD.
And what is Zero AD?
So Zero AD is a real-time strategy game, so it's totally open source, it's a free game, and you can download it for macOS, Linux and Windows. And the project has been going strong for 20 years, and we're still continuing to add new features and fix bugs.
Okay, so what is an open source strategy game?
An open source strategy game is the game where you start with like a little building and you try to expand your kingdom on map generated either by artists or by procedural code. No, procedural code is code that you write to generate maps with specific settings so that it can be randomized and create variation.
Very good. It looks very cool. What sort of hardware do you need to be able to run this? Would it run on a Raspberry Pi, for example?
Yeah, it ran on the Raspberry Pi. There is actually one on the stand right now.
Can you walk me through the stand, bearing in mind there's no picture, so you're going to have to describe everything that we see?
So, yeah, on the stand there are like a few computers and like people trying to fix stuff. Somebody experiencing, showing the game and showing how it works. And there is a little Raspberry Pi with a little screen, which proves the game works on that. So the specs are pretty low. The only downside you one could see is that if many units are moving, the game might slow down, but that's the only thing. The game is actually pretty beautiful for an open source game. And so, yeah, it should run on basically anything.
Yeah, the graphics look extremely cool. Thank you very much, and enjoy the rest of the show.
Thank you.
And I'm at the Adopt Open JDK booth, and talking to...
I'm Stuart Addison. I'm on the Adopt Open JDK Technical Steering Committee, and I sort of mostly manage the infrastructure and all the machines, and we've got some people here who do the testing and so on as well.
Okay, so one step back, what's JDK, what's Open JDK, and why do you want us to adopt it?
Nice to meet you, I'm Shelley.
So, Open JDK is the place that most people get their JDK binary from one way or another, whether it's from Oracle, Amazon, or any other provider. And what we do is we take the open source code, we build it on lots of different platforms, we run about 87 million tests every night on every build that we do, in order to hopefully give us the best quality open JDK binaries we can on as many platforms as possible. And yeah, this is the project where we do it at. It's a fully open source project. All our tools, testing, infrastructure is done with Ansible, fully open. You can run our tests if you want to, as well as we can. And so hopefully this is the best place to get your open JDK binaries from.
And so what's the purpose of being here at the booth? What are you hoping to achieve here at FOSDEM?
Just to get more publicity for the project and that sort of thing. Get people involved in it as well. If they're interested, you can contact us on GitHub and Slack. That's our main methods of communication. And yeah, just get people involved in it, get knowledge of it, and so on. And yeah, hopefully get the project the best place to get Open JDK from.
So it's openjdk.net.
That's it. Yep.
Thank you very much.
Thank you
very much. Enjoy the rest of the show. And I'm at the Apache Camel booth, and I'm talking to
Rachel McKeever.
Tell me a bit about the project, what it is.
Right, so Apache Camel is a framework or library that you can use to integrate, say, any two components, which is the concept behind Camel. And so those components can be anything from, you know, a message queue to a database to an API. And you would use Camel as a framework to, you know, allow you to communicate those two components.
What are you hoping to achieve here at the show?
Well, to bring more awareness and build a stronger community around, especially Synthesis, which is a UI that is built on top of Camel. So for people that either are not Java developers or they lack familiarity in Camel, it's powered by Camel. And you can do the same integrations in Synthesis as you can with Camel, with some limitations, obviously, but still potential to extend. And to kind of, you know, harness a community around both open source projects.
So when did this start and what license are they under?
Oh, Camel has been around for a very long time. I'm not sure, but Synthesis is quite nascent. It's just about a year or two. So, yes. Still.
The Apache license, I presume.
But Camel has been around for quite a while. There's over 500 contributors and a healthy community there as well. So.
Okay, so the website will be apachecamel.org.
So it's camel.apache.org, or Synthesis is synthesis.io.
Okay, thank you very much and enjoy the rest of the show. I'm here at the Czech MK booth and I'm talking to
Marcel Ahrens.
So, Marcel, what is Czech MK?
So, Czech MK is a full scalable monitoring tool. We are providing monitoring for almost everything, for example, infrastructure until to application monitoring, performance monitoring, status-based monitoring, event-based monitoring if you have some events like log events.
And at what level are you monitoring? Hardware or virtualization or Docker containers or processes or whereabouts do you come in?
Yeah, we do that all.
All of the above. Oh my God, how much is this?
It's pretty huge at the moment. We started with infrastructure monitoring, so hardware monitoring and SSD stuff. And then we moved on and started to integrate monitoring for VMware and virtualizations and virtual machines. And in the recent years, Docker containers and Kubernetes and all this stuff came up and we started to monitor them too.
Okay, and what sort of license are you available under?
We have currently three license models available. The first one is a completely free one. It's a raw edition. It's open source, so we are on GitHub. You can see the code.
What's the license?
It's GPL version 2. Yep. And the second one is a paid license. It's a commercial license. Yep. And the third one is in between. It's a free edition. Has all the features of the Enterprise Edition, but it's limited to 10 hosts.
And where can I find out more information about your project?
You can find more information directly on checkmk.com. Yep. You can find more information on GitHub /tribe29. Okay. That's the company behind CheckMK. And of course, you can find information about the company about in tribe29.com.
Okay, thank you very much and enjoy the rest of the show. And I'm at the Coder Dojo Belgium group, and I'm talking to
Valerie Gillon.
Hi, and tell me, what is Coder Dojo for those who don't know?
Coder Dojo is a worldwide organization that sets up a club for kids to learn how to program. It's all free, and it's led by volunteers that come once a month for 3 hours and do workshop with the kids.
In our own company, we are doing this as well, which is really cool. Yeah. So I have a question. I have, say hypothetically, three children who, yes, none of them want to do coding. So how do I get them interested in coding?
Well, if they really don't want to, then you should not force them, because you're going to do worse damage than anything. But if they're a bit enthusiastic, they could come over with our coaches. They'll learn how to make their own program, own game, or animated stories or whatever. And it's usually a lot of fun. But some kids don't like it, and that's okay. You have to just try it once.
As I say to them, sooner or later, you will be sitting in front of a laptop. So, yeah. So if you have a So how does one go about getting a coder dojo into your school or into your business? Or how does that happen?
Okay, we already have dojos in Belgium. We have about 140 dojos running. But in the world, there's about more than 1,000 dojos running. And you just have to check either on Coder Dojo Belgium or coderdojo.com to see if there's a dojo in your neighborhood. And then you can go over there. If there's none, you could start one. It's really not complicated. In Belgium, just contact us and we'll help you with all the steps. It's finding a place where you can have a dojo and finding volunteers that help you out. And then we help you with the material and everything and the logistics. And then up, you're going.
Okay, so what, describe to me a typical day that I walk in with my kids, and then what happens?
Usually it's weekends. It's Saturday on Sundays, but we have some dojos running in the Wednesday afternoon, but it's mostly weekends because programmers do work during the week, and then so they're free on over the weekend.
Okay, and what can you expect to happen as one of these events?
Well, it's usually, when they come in, they're like, oh my God, everything is so quiet and there's like 50 kids around here because they're all into the programming mode. It really differs from one dojo to the other because it differs with the volunteers that come and what technology they want to use. Some of them use MBOTS robots. Some of them use microbits like we have here. And others use Scratch or Python or C with Arduinos. It really varies from one dojo to the other.
Okay, thank you very much, and enjoy the rest of the show. And I'm at the Eclipse Foundation booth, and I'm talking to
Michael Barbero.
Hi, Michael. And what is the Eclipse Foundation, and why do I care?
So the Eclipse Foundation is a not-for-profit organization. We started as the host of the Eclipse IDE project. But today we have many more of them. We have 275 projects hosted at the Eclipse Foundation, and the scope of those projects is very large. We have some projects dedicated for cloud native Java like Jakarta IE. We have of course the Eclipse IDE still to do Java development, but not only. We also have C environment, PHP environment, REST environment, web development environment. And we also have projects around the IoT, from the edge to the gateway and even to dashboards and controllers. And we also have projects around the automotive industry.
Okay. And what are you hoping to achieve here today by having a booth at FOSDEM?
So we are there to evangelize about our project. So the foundation itself, we don't participate actively in project. We don't code. We just provide infrastructure, processes, development processes, IP processes, for the project. So we are there to talk about what we provide to projects. So if some new project wants to come to join the foundation and also evangelize about the project that are already there.
Okay, fantastic. Enjoy the rest of the show. We're here at the GitLab booth, and I'm talking to
David Polonella, Director of Community Relations at GitLab.
So I know what GitLab is because we host our source code in GitLab, but for the listeners, can you tell them what GitLab is?
GitLab is essentially the single application for the full DevOps cycle. So in that regard, we have many different stages that we offer in one single product where you can control the whole life cycle of your application, essentially modernizing your DevOps workflow.
So even though you're not going to say it, this will be a more free version of GitHub?
Kind of. So GitLab is essentially an open core project, meaning that we have two versions. One that's completely open source under an open source license, and then we have the what we call the Enterprise Edition, which is available with to paid customers. Even then, though, all of the source code that we release is public. The only difference is the license between them.
So, what license do you release under?
It's a modified version of the MIT license. For the proprietary part, it's a proprietary GitLab license.
Okay, and what are you hoping to do here today?
Oh, wow, to meet lots of contributors, lots of people who are interested in GitLab, get some good stories, and then essentially let people know that they can use GitLab for free. They can use GitLab paid for as well if they need the extra features.
And we're also meeting quite a lot of projects or project leaders who are been migrating to GitLab or who are continuing to migrate to GitLab. We've been talking to Debian, to GNOME, to KDE, to the Eclipse Foundation. And it's also good to see people in real life, face-to-face, finally.
Obviously. Thank you very much. Enjoy the rest of the show and thanks for taking the time. Hi, everybody. I'm at the GNU Health booth and I'm talking to
Axel Braun.
And what is GNU Health and why is it here?
Actually, GNU Health is a free, as in freedom, health and hospital management system. It contains basically all components that you need to either run a practitioner's office or even run a hospital, with hospital management, with bed management, with operation rooms, professional inpatient management, outpatient management, with pharmacy, for example, with a laboratory management system, and in the back, of course, financial accounting and everything that you need. So basically, it's a full-fledged ERP system that you need to run a hospital or a practice.
How long has it been going?
GNU Health is now, I think, 11 or 12 years old.
And is it deployed in many places?
Well, we have, it's always the issue with free software project. You don't know who is really using it because they don't have to phone home. But we know of a couple of implementations in South America. This is where the project originally started. South America, Middle America, we have currently many projects going on in Africa, partly together with World Health Organization and the local Ministry of Health. We have implementations from small primary care stations in the rainforest, which work really under rough conditions, who may only have a couple of hours electricity per day, up to the largest hospital in Asia, the Institute of Medical Science, and located in Delhi, with about 3,500 beds, who's currently implementing GNU Health as well.
And what sort of license is it released under?
It's under GPL version 3. So, and this is one of our core values of our philosophy. It has to be a free software package without kinks and borders.
Okay, very good. And where would I find out more about the project if I was looking to help?
Visit our website, gnuhealth.org, or join a mailing list, which is health@gnu.org. GNU Health is an official GNU project.
Okay, very good. And have you had any issues getting it approved by bodies like the FDA or such?
Well, that's the point. It's used in many areas where you don't have high legal regulations. For example, we have a couple of implementations in Germany as well, but none of them is allowed to bill with the public health system because you need certain certifications for that. And as long as not somebody is stepping up to say, hey, we're doing this certification, and then we're issuing it in the market, it's not being made. That's the full story behind it.
Okay. Well, thanks very much for taking the time and enjoy the rest of the show.
Thank you.
And I'm at the JavaScript stand, and I'm talking to
Marta.
Okay, so what is the JavaScript stand, please?
Yeah, so we are doing this together with the community of JavaScript developers in Belgium that we have as part of our company Hackages. So we are just...
So your company is Hackages?
Yes, our company is Hackages, and we do all things JavaScript, a lot of community events and trainings. So we decided to do the JavaScript Dev Room last year already with a few people from the community, and we repeated the experience this year.
And you're just here to get some, stir up some interest then in JavaScript.
Yeah, so the idea, we have a little quiz with JavaScript questions to put a little bit the knowledge of the people to the test, and we have, that is also connected to the schedule tomorrow, and then we have stickers from a lot of JavaScript technologies and a lot of JavaScript conferences, just because people love stickers and we want to share it with them.
Exactly. Post-dem runs and stickers, I reckon. So what are you hoping to achieve here today at the table?
But we just want to meet people who like JavaScript and maybe people who would like to be engaged in our community as well and just spread the word about tomorrow's Dev Room so it's full and it's a success like last year.
And if somebody wanted to start learning JavaScript, to be honest, I've always wanted to, but I couldn't find somewhere just to kick off to do the Hello World program. Where is the best place to go?
That's a tricky question, because we normally do JavaScript for people who already know how to code. So I think you will have to go... You already know how to code. Okay, then we are all in for face-to-face trainings, short periods. For us, it's much more helpful than online. But okay, it depends a bit. Obviously, we do it at Hackages, but we know other great partners all around Europe and the world who do it as well.
And that's Hackages.
Yeah, so Hackages, we offer trainings for professional developers on JavaScript, but then Vue.js, React, Angular, all things JavaScript, and the community events, which are also a way to get started on these technologies and give it a try for free.
And what's your website?
Hackages.io.
Perfect. Thank you very much. Enjoy the rest of the show. And I'm at the Jenkins Jenkins X booth, and I'm talking to
Cara de la Marque.
And can you tell me what Jenkins X is?
Yes, Jenkins X is a complete rebuild of CI/CD on Kubernetes. It's written in Go. And what it provides for you is in a very opinionated workflow, which has best GitOps practices built in from the start. And your pipelines, they're opinionated, but they are extensible as well. So you can customize it to your use case. When you're using Jenkins X and you install it on your Kubernetes cluster, it will set up your pipelines for you, including dev, staging, production environments that map to Kubernetes namespaces. It also spins up Git repos for you that, yes. So it gives you, exactly, it gives you best GitOps practices from the start. So the entire state of your system is in Git, and any changes to your system, you put them in Git.
And everything comes from there.
Yes, So in addition, when you make a change to your system through Git and your CI tests pass, your changes will be automatically promoted to staging. And what's spun up for you is called a preview environment. It's very similar to spinning up your application on localhost and seeing the changes, except it's done for you and you're given a link within your PR. And anyone on your team then can click on that link, can see your changes. It's a great way to be able to very quickly get fast feedback on changes that you're trying to make, to see exactly what those changes will be, to collaborate with your team. It works beautifully for a team workflow.
But surely this will completely decimate the Jenkins project.
Oh, no. As you see, we're together. We're very friendly. Like, we collaborate all the time, and they're very different projects. So Jenkins X is for CI/CD on Kubernetes. And Jenkins, as we know, you know, it's a much wider user base. It's much more extensible with its plugins. And it does have a Kubernetes plugin as well. But Jenkins X is completely made for Kubernetes from the get-go. It is complete reconception, rebuild from scratch. And because the two projects are actually quite different, it's very easy for us to collaborate and work together.
So are there any, what would the migration strategy from a traditional Jenkins pipeline be to going to Jenkins X?
We have now just made, Andrew Baer has just made a tool that will help convert your declarative Jenkins pipelines to Jenkins X pipelines. So that really helps people move from Jenkins to Jenkins X should they wish to do so.
Okay, thank you very much and enjoy the rest of the show.
Great, thank you.
I'm at the Copano booth and I'm talking to
Brian Joseph, co-founder of Copano.
What is Copano?
Copano is 100% GPL compliant open source collaboration, which means groupware, email, calendar, task, and contacts, and also a full WebRTC implementation accessed by a progressive web app for mobiles, desktops, and tablets.
Let me guess, on the back end, you're using standard open protocols?
Yes, definitely. We are compliant with standard open protocols. At the same time, we implemented the very challenging Microsoft protocols, like we open source an open MAPI implementation for optimal advanced calendar usage, and also ActiveSync, which is a very close protocol. And with the project Zpush, we made an open source server-side ActiveSync implementation also used by other groupware solutions.
Okay, we've already done this interview before. So you were saying that it was already in Debian.
Yes, we are in Debian Buster. So that was very important, very good to see. That's also why we are here, to work together with other developers and to ensure our packages get in the right way in Debian repositories.
And how difficult is it to set up this server?
It is for the good thing is that we integrate seemingly with existing MTAs like mails, like Postfix or Sendmail. So that makes it very easy for people with Linux knowledge to implement it. At the same time, we have Docker images of our solution, making it also easy for people with Kubernetes clusters, for example, to easily roll out and maintain this solution.
Perfect. Thank you very much. Oh, we were talking about the video chat earlier on. You support video chat. How does that work?
It works. It's a WebRTC implementation. Yeah. Maybe you can even show a bit, which is not visible on audio, of course. But it is it's an implementation where we have a so-called progressive web app, where you can easily interact with people in your organization, but also with one click invite others. Okay. And you see here right now, not visible for the listeners, but you see our video solution where you can make so-called groups, rooms, and you can easily send people invites to connect to public groups or to private groups.
And how many simultaneous users can you have in a meeting?
We have right now, if it's just a one-on-one calls, you can do it easily with, let's say, 8 people. If you want to do really big, that's all peer-to-peer and encrypted. That's very important. When you want to do webinars, we have a server-side solution where you can connect with way more people.
And that's using Matrix or technology?
You can integrate that with solutions like Matrix. We are right now busy integrating this solution together with the Matrix team.
Okay, very cool. Can I have a look at the this network diagram, and I'll describe it to people. So what we've got is a MySQL MariaDB layer with a server on top of that, and connecting in, we have MTAs connecting to spoolers and agents, and then the gateways connect to IMAP and POP3 clients. CalDAV connects through the OpenMuse guys next door MuseScore guys next door are making noise. Then on the web server with PHP 5 and higher, we have the Copano web app and the Zpush client, and the Copano web app has gone up to standard browsers and the Copano desktop, whereas the Zpush is going to ActiveSync protocol and Outlook 2013 and 2016. And then on the right we have all the bindings for various different backup solutions, presences, and APIs. Pretty textbook open sort of project by the look of it. So thank you very much for the second interview. And CERN has switched to Copano mail server for its 40,000 users. Awesome. 40,000. Excellent. Now I'm distracting myself by reading this when I should actually be recording. So I'm going to put that away. Say thank you again for the excellent interview, and enjoy the rest of the show. I'm at the CubeVert and Metal 3 stand, and I'm talking to
Daniel Hiller.
Mario Vasquez.
And what is CubeVert and what is Metal 3?
CubeVert is an extension to Kubernetes to run your virtual machines inside a Kubernetes cluster.
Okay, that seems very obvious. And what's Metal 3?
Metal 3 is an implementation of the cluster API for deploying Kubernetes clusters on top of bare metal.
Okay, very good. And why would I do that? And what is Kubernetes? Just for a start, for people who don't know.
Kubernetes is a service to make your development hassles for developers easier, right? So it's always the infrastructure which is pain for developers to have to set up, for example, like when it comes to auto-scaling deployments or something like that, which Kubernetes is very good at automating this for you.
Yeah, so bringing up Docker containers and putting them in and doing the networking and stuff. And
if something is not working anymore, Kubernetes is detecting it and starting a new container, for example, and so on.
Why specifically, so you run Kubernetes on bare metal. Why specifically bare metal?
Yeah, so we think that running Kubernetes directly on top of bare metal is a good idea because Kubernetes is already in charge of, you know, managing all the infrastructure and running next to the hardware. It's really useful for some applications like, for example, machine learning workloads and these kind of things that you need like to be really near to the bare metal or real-time kernels, these kind of things.
Okay, very good. But how do you deal with so many different types of hardware, and how do you take advantage of new cool stuff coming up?
So in MetalQ, what we have is we communicate with the different bare metal providers using IPMI. So you only need your hardware to have a management interface card that supports IPMI, like iDRAC or ILO, whatever.
So where can I find out more information about your projects?
It's kubernetes.io, for example, or you can have the mailing list also, and it's...
Yeah, it's metal3.io, and as well we have a mailing list, then we have a Slack channel in the Kubernetes Slack, which is cluster API bare metal, where you can find us.
Perfect. Links in the show notes. Metal cubed, I imagine, because then it makes sense. Okay, great. Thank you very much, and enjoy the rest of the show.
The MicroPython and Esprino booth.
And your name is?
Gordon Williams.
And your name is?
Christine Spindler.
Okay, so who wants to start?
What's up? Oh, okay.
So can you tell me what Esprino is?
Yeah, it's a JavaScript interpreter for microcontrollers. So we're actually sharing a booth because we're both trying to do the same kind of thing, which is to run a scripting language on a microcontroller. And Esprino is a completely open source project that targets reasonably low-end microcontrollers, sort of the sweet spots around the 64K of RAM side of things. Yeah. And it's basically just trying to make them much easier to program than they might have been if you used C. So I guess a good example of that's Bluetooth, where learning Nordic Semiconductor's Bluetooth stack is a kind of really steep learning curve. So if we can take that and we can abstract it away and allow you to make a Bluetooth keyboard with a few lines of JavaScript, then that's going to allow a lot more people to use the hardware than would have previously been able to.
Okay, and what's your relationship with the project?
So I'm the guy that started it and that also works kind of full-time on it at the moment. So what we do is I try to be entirely open. The software's open, all the hardware I design is open, and while the interpreter will run on a bunch of different hardware, I sell hardware that has it pre-installed, and it's basically the sales of that hardware that that funds the continued work on it.
What license do you release your hardware and software under?
We use MPL V2 for the software, and... it's just a Creative Commons for the hardware.
Okay, very good. I might move over to you just for 1 second. And you're trying to do the same thing for MicroPython.
Yes, MicroPython is Python for microcontrollers, so you don't need an operating system to run your Python code. You run the Python code bare metal.
And what's your relationship with the MicroPython project?
Well, I'm responsible for manufacturing the hardware, and so I run all the logistic processes and coordinate all the manufacturing.
So do you sell a particular board or something? Are you developing separate hardware?
Yes, we have the nice thing about it is that the software and hardware comes from one vendor. So we actually design our hardware to fit the software our software needs.
So I'm reasonably familiar with MicroPython, but more in the sense that you take an ESP32 board and put MicroPython on it. But this seems to be different. There seems to be a hardware. This is something new for me.
Yes, well, there's an official MicroPython hardware, which is the STM line, with STM32. And now the new board is running an F7, an ARM7 controller. And yeah, most people are familiar with MicroPython through the ESP, which is also supported by us. But we fund basically the open source project to sell through selling the hardware.
And is this a profitable business? Are you making enough money to continue as a project?
Well, I would say we never make enough money, but we love what we do and we still keep it going, yes. And we definitely want to have a MicroPython open source because we think that's how we grow.
I think the same question will be for both of you. I'll ask you the question more from the MicroPython point of view. Is this not kind of bloatware, having Python running on a device when you should be really doing assembler or say or something like that?
Well, it depends, because the microcontrollers get more and more powerful. So sometimes you struggle. Well, that's how I was when I did my electrical engineering degree. I was more struggling with getting something working in the first place. And that was not even targeting my main project, like keeping something really low power, for example. So if I have my special target, I can focus still with assembler or C nicely embedded in my MicroPython, but I get my SD card reader working and everything works around. And that's the nice thing about it.
Okay, yes, that makes a lot more sense. Are you selling stuff here today? Can you walk through some of the stuff that's available at your website, which is?
You can find everything online on micropython.org.
And you're supporting a great community. So let's do the sales pitch here and see what you've got.
Well, at the moment, we still sell our original PyBot, which is from 6 years ago now and still sells. And we just released last year our PyBot D, which is more targeted towards industrial customers, which build them already in their products. So the engineers, I would call them, like to have an up and running system that's already, they don't have to worry about the brain of their devices and can just focus on their actual surroundings to develop their own PCBs.
Excellent. Awesome stuff. Can I ask about your earrings? Do they run MicroPython?
Not yet, no. They're just the plain PCBs because they're so nice.
Absolutely awesome. My daughters would love them. Thank you very much for taking the time and enjoy the rest of the show.
Thanks to you.
And I'm at the New Spell booth and I'm talking to
Sander van Geloven.
Hoi Sander, alles goed met u?
Ja, prima.
So, New Spell is a spell checker. What is a spell checker?
A spell checker is more than just looking up words in a long list to see if they're spelled correctly. A spell checker looks at a dictionary which contains a lot of rules, sort of called affix file rules, which capture conjugation of verbs, for example, or how you can concatenate words into compounds. And that makes it much more smart to do spell checking than just looking at a long list of words. But that also opens the door for a lot of complexity, challenges how to do that quickly. And not only checking words, but also coming up with suggestions if you made a misspell. And that is quite a challenge, but that's the task of a spell checker.
Okay, so we always have, you know, you see this spell checking libraries on your computer, Hunspell and other ones. So what is different with NewSpell?
So the dictionaries are made for each spell checker that was out there. So if you go back in history, first you had Spell, then you had iSpell, then you had aSpell, then you had MySpell, then you had Hunspell. Now you have NewSpell, and there are also more specific checkers for example, only Hebrew. And each spell checker has an engine which needs to be fed with language-specific support. And the language-specific support, which is made for Hunspell, is also usable in NewSpell. And it's like 90 different languages are being supported by different dictionaries. And these 90 languages cover about almost 200 different regions or countries in the world where people speak or write a certain language.
But why would I install this?
You would like to install this because it's much quicker. And you might not notice it when you do spell checking on a single word. But if you check your entire document, you have a large document, and your language is more complicated, so it uses a lot of compounds, for example, then it is CPU intensive, and that with NuSpell it's going to be much quicker.
Shinier, faster, better. And is it available in all the distros, or do I need to compile it from scratch?
Well, since yesterday we brought out Debian packages for Debian and Ubuntu. It's also been packaged for FreeBSD. It's not available yet in those distributions, but we're working on that. You can also compile it from source code. It's with CMake, if you know that.
Okay. And what are you hoping to achieve here today at the show?
We hope to find more people to let our community grow, especially on the language binding part. We hope to find people, because it's implemented in C++, so we have a C++ and C API. But we're looking forward for all the languages like Python, Java, JavaScript, you can name it, that there is language binding so people can use it from their environment.
Okay, thank you very much and enjoy the rest of the show. I'm at the OpenHAB booth and I'm talking to
Thomas.
Hi, Thomas. Can you tell me what OpenHAB is and why you're here?
Simply, OpenHAB is great, but I'm sure that's not enough.
Well, it wouldn't be enough. It has to be great to be at FOSDEM, so let's move on.
Yeah, that's true. OpenHAB is a platform to integrate several smart home systems.
Yeah.
For example, Philips Hue and Z-Wave systems or Zigbee, so they can interoperate to each other.
Those systems that you've mentioned are known for being not the most open in the world. How are you getting around that?
That depends on the system. As far as I know, I'm the typical user of OpenHAB. Some guys re-engineered the Z-Wave protocol, so that's there. Other protocols like Philips Hue, they have an API that can be accessed freely and OpenHAB.
So what have we got here on the table in front of us, and can you walk us through what the demo setup is?
Yeah, it's our demo setup. Unfortunately, it's not working at the moment.
Well, nobody would have known if you hadn't said it. Now you've ruined it.
but we have a better thing. We have a live demo of my home automation system.
Yeah.
So if I click on the PC and switch the light on, my wife will call me and say, "What are you doing? The heck, you're in Brussels and not at home. Stop it." Typical setup. OpenHAB is designed to run on small systems like the Pine or Raspberry Pi.
Yeah.
But it also runs on Windows systems or virtual machine, whatever is capable of running a Java system.
Yeah, so it's written in Java.
It's written in Java.
And there's a web front end, I presume.
We have different web front ends, and we are currently in the process to combine them all together in one really nice user interface. And you can develop your own interface. You see here mine, it's very straightforward. Other people do other things with the predefined interfaces.
Do you have Android apps and iOS applications?
Yeah. I can show to you. It looks
It's awesome. Look at that. Completely bug-free and working perfectly. Excellent. People can get more information on your website, which is?
www.openhab.org.
Perfect. Thank you very much and enjoy the rest of the show.
You're welcome.
And I'm at the OpenStack Foundation booth and I'm talking to
Jeremy Stanley. I'm on the staff of the OpenStack Foundation. Also been on the vulnerability management team for OpenStack for a very long time. Maintainer of the Zool open source CI/CD system.
So one step back. What's OpenStack?
OpenStack is basically, we like to refer to it as a cloud operating system. It's a framework for managing infrastructure at scale to provide elastic resources on demand for users who want to be able to have a self-service sort of experience with infrastructure management.
auto-scaling, that type of thing?
Auto-scaling and providing consistent APIs across a variety of different kinds of hardware resources.
Okay, would this be kind of like Kubernetes, or...?
Think of a layer below Kubernetes. What are you going to install Kubernetes on, and do you want to have the ability to control all of the systems that you're running your Kubernetes on top of through some sort of API that you can plug into your automation systems or configuration management?
Okay, and what's the reason for being here at Foster?
I'm here as a representative of the OpenStack Foundation, and we in turn represent a number of different open free software projects that basically have come together around management of infrastructure.
Okay, very good. Okay, thank you very much, and enjoy the rest of the show.
I'm at the OpenTap booth, and I'm talking to Michael. Hi, and what is OpenTap?
OpenTap is a test automation platform, which is enabling people to do test automation for physical devices or virtual devices.
And how do you go about doing that?
So it's an open source project. So it started from a commercial product, which is sold by Keysight, where it's deployed today in a commercial solution where we are running manufacturing tests in many, many places. Manufacturing can be of a cell phone or a base station or a physical device.
Yeah.
And basically what we did was to open source the core of our product such that people can connect their own device or their own instruments to it. So it's an architecture where the core is open source and the people are basically developing plugins to connect to it.
Okay, but how far would I need to go before I start using proprietary code?
So you can basically go all the way without proprietary code. So the open source can be used as such, the core, and you can develop your own plugin completely open source. We have a set of reference plugins as well, which are open source on the website that can be downloaded as well. And then you can create whatever you wish around that from an infrastructure perspective.
And what's the website for your project?
So opentap.io, that's okay. The website.
Thank you very much, and enjoy the rest of the show.
Thank you.
And I'm at the Open UK booth, and I'm talking to
Amanda Brock.
Hi, Amanda. Given the day that it is, one day, Brexit minus one, why are the Open UK booth here at FOSDEM?
We're here to make sure that we don't get forgotten. So the UK has an awful lot of people who work in different areas of us and open technology, whether it's hardware, software, or data. And we're not really recognised by our geographical location. What's happened is that we've engaged massively globally in projects, and we don't know each other.
Yep.
So Open UK is trying to bring everybody in the UK together. Don't all have to like each other, we just have to get along enough to work together. And once we're together, we create a voice for Open in the UK. And that voice is one that will be really obvious and loud, and hopefully we'll be able to engage and collaborate with everybody in Europe and beyond.
And within, so is the goal a political one as well within the UK?
What do you mean by political?
Pushing for open standards, open document formats, open government.
Yeah, that's interesting. If you mean that by political, to an extent it is, and we've already managed to get quite a lot of engagement with UK government across different departments. We're really a very new organisation, and our forum with the Open Technology Remit has only existed since the 15th of January. We had our first main board meeting then, and we came up with our purpose, our vision, and our mission then. Already we've got, I think, four or five government departments engaging with us, looking for us to help advise. So we're really keen to get everybody in the UK talking to us so that we can keep people in touch and make sure that the right people are speaking to the right people to influence government.
There are already quite a lot of open organisations that I'm aware of, even something like OddCamp in the UK, which is a podcasting podcasting event that's near and dear to my own heart. So would the idea be that that organisation would come and become friends with you guys?
I couldn't have put it better. So we actually have a space on our website for friends. And we have a sort of very short agreement, which it's not onerous. The idea is that everybody will cooperate. We will let you use our logo. You'll let us use yours. But more, it's about making sure that if you're looking into the UK, there's a central place that you can find all those great organizations. everybody's doing good work. Sometimes they're hard to locate. Sometimes people don't know what they do. So we display their logos with a click through to their sites. We've also got a calendar being built that should launch in the next week or two. And the calendar has our events. So it has the UK events we know about and the major international events we want to share. So if you have an event in the UK and you want it listed, there's going to be a contact box in there for you to send us the information. And actually, we had a booth at Og Camp, which you mentioned a few months ago. It's definitely going to be on there once they've got their date. We're waiting for Simon Phipps to go to the date.
Excellent. Thank you very much and enjoy the rest of the show. And I'm at the Open Wi-Fi booth, and I'm talking to
Xianjun Jiao, which is the main developer of the Open Wi-Fi.
Okay, Open Wi-Fi, it seems fairly explanatory.
Mm-hmm. Actually, that explains nothing. That's a puzzle name. Okay, actually, what is Open Wi-Fi? In one sentence, Open Wi-Fi is an open source Wi-Fi chip design.
So what does that mean? Is the protocol itself open, or is this a hardware project or a software project or both?
You can call it FPGA project, because FPGA, you know, when we tape out a Wi-Fi chip, FPGA is always the intermediate step before you tape out a real Wi-Fi chip, right? Because tape out costs lots of money. You don't want it to be fail. So you do FPGA first. Currently, we have open source our Wi-Fi chip design in the FPGA phase. That means you have access on GitHub to all the FPGA code, which is in Verilog. And we also develop or open source our own Wi-Fi chip driver in Linux, because most of the Wi-Fi chip, they work in the Linux, right? In your cell phone, in your laptop, they need driver. Then your Linux will recognize your chip as the network interface. Another sentence, Open Wi-Fi project. We open source all the code from antenna to Linux application.
Oh, wait, from the hardware the whole way up?
Yes, full stack.
Actually, before that, because you're open sourcing the designs right through the hardware up to the kernel.
Sorry, what's the
question? Well, by releasing the code for the designs of the chips, you're actually even before the hardware.
Well, that depends on how you define hardware. Currently, our hardware is used off-the-shelf FPGA development board from Xilinx and from Analog Device. They offer a development board for people to try their FPGA chip or the front-end chip. You know, FPGA is a programmable chip. By our design, we turn this FPGA to a Wi-Fi chip.
So with that, I could take your code and I could make a Wi-Fi chip then, could I?
Yes, that's one of the use cases. If you are a company that are trying to build your own Wi-Fi chip, maybe for special use case, right? For drone, for train, for aircraft, you have some special use case. You want to tailor the commercial Wi-Fi chip for your use case. Then you go for big company, Broadcom, Qualcomm. Would you please customize a Wi-Fi chip for my application? Then the first question you get is, how big the volume per year? Then you will get rid of the customer list, because your niche market, your volume is quite low. In that case, you can build your own Wi-Fi chip, start from our design, because our design is white box, right? And or you want to build some open source hardware for some open source computer, like open source phone, open source laptop, open source computer. Computer, you need CPU, no problem. You have Linux there, but you always need to access internet via some connection chip. Could be Wi-Fi chip, currently, or commercial Wi-Fi chip. If you want to build open source Wi-Fi chip, then start from our solution would be ideal.
Okay, fantastic. But is there not some legal requirements that you're not allowed to broadcast that the chips need to go through validation and then they need to adhere to Wi-Fi or they need to adhere to radio spectrum? How do you get around that, or is that the problem of the manufacturer?
Yes, that's true. That's the problem of the chip vendor. We position ourselves as a solution or reference design yes. vendor, right?
Yeah.
As you know, all the software-defined radio platform, they are capable of violating any FCC or radio spectrum rule, right? Everyone knows that. But for research or development, you need that kind of hardware. But how hardware run, it depends on developer, right? In this case, if you try to tape out your own Wi-Fi chip based on our design, then it will be your duty to align with regulation. It will be your duty to test your Wi-Fi chip in the Wi-Fi Alliance. Yes.
Completely get it. Thank you very much. So what are we seeing here on the table?
On the table is our reference design running on the off-the-shelf FPGA development board.
Yeah.
Right? In this design, there is the black thing is the system on chip, Xilinx Zynq 7000 chip, FPGA chip.
Yeah.
In the chip, there are two parts,
yeah.
ARM processor and FPGA.
Yeah.
On the ARM processor, embedded Linux is running,
yeah.
and AP software is running in the Linux. Our Wi-Fi driver also running in the Linux. On the FPGA part, our Wi-Fi chip design is implemented. So basically, the board is currently it's configured as a Wi-Fi router
yeah.
without any commercial Wi-Fi chip on board.
So it's 100% open source.
Yes. But our code 100% open source under AGPL V3.
Yeah.
But you should realize, as a complicated full solution,
yeah.
we don't deliver everything, you know. We have to rely on some IP from other company.
Yeah.
Like we start from analog device reference design.
Yeah.
We start from Xilinx reference design, where there are many essential infrastructure IP, right?
Yeah.
Like the Xilinx has the DMA controller, analog device has the IP to control their RF frontend.
Yeah.
We rely on those infrastructure IP.
Yeah.
On top of that, we deliver the basic, the Wi-Fi IP.
Okay. Thank you very much for taking the time and enjoy the rest of the show.
Thanks.
And I'm at the OWASP booth, that's the Open Web Application Security Project, and I'm talking to
Antonis Manaras.
So what is this project?
Essentially, OWASP is an organization, global organization, non-profit organization that focuses on secure coding, on how the developers can learn to code in a secure way. So we have a lot of projects under OWASP that could be a tool, that could be any kind of project with focus on web application security. We also have conferences in US, in Europe, in Asia every year, local chapter meetings, and there, of course there is a big community from volunteers that interact with each other. And OWASP has a lot of resources and guidelines online, and it is considered to be the state of the art. If you want to, if you are a developer and you want to learn about secure coding, you will visit OWASP material. It's very popular on that.
So regardless of whether what type of coding you're doing, but
web application, essentially, that is the main focus, and mobile application coding mainly, not infrastructure that much.
Do you offer any sort of code review services or not?
No, OWASP doesn't offer any kind of service. It's just the open source, the open community, let's say, so that both developers and security professionals can come together and interact and help each other.
So what's the purpose of being here at FOSDEM this weekend?
Yeah, we came here as we are an open organization. We came to promote this openness, to invite people to participate in both developer place on the or the security professionals and everyone that wants to learn about security in general, web application security.
Okay, thank you very much and enjoy the rest of the show. Hi, I'm at the Percona booth and I'm talking to
Yevgeny Petlan, builder list engineer in Percona.
Hi, and you say you're an open source database expert. What makes you say that?
We provide support and consulting for all of available databases. MySQL, MongoDB, PostgreSQL. We provide our own distributions, our forks, and so on.
And why are you here at FOSDEM?
Because all our software is open source.
All your software is open source?
Yeah, we provide everything we do as an open source.
And where can I get more information on your project?
You can get it from our site, percona.com, and in our booth.
Perfect. Thank you very much. Enjoy the rest of the show.
Hi, and I'm talking to
Koen. This is Koen Bergsand at GitHub and in a lot of places. And I'm writing firmware for the Pinetime.
What is the Pinetime?
The Pinetime is a Pine64 smartwatch. It's open hardware. It's available right now. I think development kits are available. And the fun thing about Pinetime is that you can program it yourself. You receive it with a stock firmware image, which appears to be some kind of Chinese stock image. Yeah. And people are doing all kinds of stuff with it. It's possible to program it yourself. There are debug headers exposed. And you hook it up to your computer and you can start programming.
Can I have a look at it?
Yes, of course.
Let me just describe this to the listeners. It's a watch. No, it's a watch with a... he turned it over. At the front, it looks like a watch. Like an ordinary watch. When you turn it over, it's got two soldering pads. What are they? Describe this to me.
This is the power. You have this cradle where you can plug it in and it will charge.
So like Pogo ports.
Yes. Yeah. A bit comparable, I think, to Pebble or your regular smartwatch. In the middle, we see the heart rate sensor. I don't have it working yet, but it should work fine, theoretically. And then there is my modification to the Pinetime.
I must say your modification is a bit...
It's interesting,
I know. It is, yes, yes.
It's a bit crude. The issue with programming is that you have to pop off the back of the Pinetime. Yeah. There are four small pads exposed. You plug in your programming header, and it's all finicky and, well...
So you basically put two wires out the back that you can plug into. Okay, so now I'm going to... Oh, and that's why the insulating tape is around the side. So I'm now going to describe the phone without the insulating tape. It looks quite nice. How do you get it to work?
There's a button on the side.
So you press the button on the side.
Turns on, shows you the time, excitingly.
Yeah.
Shows you the battery level and the battery voltage and the date.
So it's an OLED screen?
It's a TFT IPS panel.
Okay.
240 by 240 pixels. Rather simple. Sufficient, I would say.
So what do you do with this?
My main idea was... my main goal is to have it functional, to wear it around my wrist for a day, was to have it show the time. Yeah, good plan, I know. And I don't want to enter the time manually on the tiny screen. So I started around playing with Bluetooth, first time playing around with Bluetooth, and I managed to synchronize time over Bluetooth. Gives you the time. There's a standardized
NGP
surface. Yeah. Standardized way. Implemented it, got the time on there. That's it for
job
now.
Done. Excellent. Excellent.
Yeah. I'm working on the battery level. I'm working on applications, so you can add applications to your firmware. So people can design their own applications, compile a new firmware, flash it on there, and there's the application on it. And maybe it's a stopwatch, maybe it's a heart rate graph, maybe it's a step counter.
Oh, cool. It opens it up. How difficult is it to get the firmware on? How difficult would it be for me, a non-techie, cool, hardcore developer like yourself, to get firmware on there?
There are a number of blogs out there that describe the whole process. It's not as easy as an apt install your software. But if you read the guides, if you order your programmer online, then it's doable. It's even possible to grab a Raspberry Pi, hook it up to the Raspberry Pi GPIOs, and start programming it.
How much is it?
It's hard. It's medium.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time, and enjoy the rest of the day.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Oh, you want it back?
Yeah, I want this back.
Thank you.
and I'm at the PostgreSQL booth, and I'm talking to
Benji.
Hi, Benji. What is PostgreSQL?
So PostgreSQL will build a GraphQL API for you automatically by inspecting your Postgres database.
So I have a Postgres database. Can you tell me what that graph is?
Sure. So we'll look at your tables, your relations, indexes, your permissions, functions that you have in your database, and other such things. And we will then turn that into a GraphQL API. GraphQL is a new technology, was open sourced in 2015, managed now under the GraphQL Foundation, which is under the Linux Foundation, used industry-wide, and it's a new query language for APIs to query from, for example, a web or mobile front-end.
So this allows you to put parameters upon parameters upon parameters?
Yes, so you can effectively specify exactly what fields you want whilst you're in your mobile app. Say, I need to know information about this user and their friends and their friends' interests. And you effectively write a query that describes everything you need, and then you send that to the server. What we'll do as PostgreSQL is we'll interpret that with GraphQL, and then we'll send it onto the database and write a very efficient query against the database, which will give you back just that data that you need. And then that goes back through the chain, and you get it back as your front-end developer. And it's very, very optimized for front-end developers to be able to use easily and for the database to be able to execute very efficiently.
Sounds almost too good to be true.
I like to think so.
So, yes. Yes. And what sort of licenses are released under?
So PostgreSQL is under the MIT license. Very, very liberal.
Okay. And what are you hoping to achieve by being at FOSDEM this year?
Just raising awareness of the project, really, and also making connections with other interesting open source people.
And where would I go to get more information on the project?
So you can go to graphile.org. That's GRAPHILE.org.
Okay, thank you very much, and enjoy the rest of the show.
Thank you.
I'm at the techkids.ev booth, and I'm talking to
Niels.
Niels, thank you very much, and thanks to your father for giving permission to record this, because how old are you?
I'm 15 years old.
And you're at a booth here in FOSDEM.
Yes, so we are an organization based in Germany, and we are trying to bring free and open source software into schools.
Okay, good luck with that. How are you planning on doing that?
So we are developing different tools, for example, like Alexis or EduGit, Debian Edu, and they are basically offering everything a school needs to manage their everyday school life. So, for example, timetables, substitution plans, and everything. And the advantage of this is that the schools don't have to change to fit for the program, but that the schools are able to change the program so that it fits to the school.
So this is a bit like in the Netherlands, we have Magister, which is an online closed source application that you need to log in, and they have your timetables and if somebody is free and vacant. Who came up with this project?
So it was an idea of Dominic Georges, so it's our leader of the organization. And he created this organization, and so we have different teams in our organization, which are all doing different stuff, for example, like administration, organization, and so on. And our tools are being developed by minors, so by children and so on, and just like those tools. So it was a team idea, basically.
Wow, that is absolutely awesome. And, are you having much success? Have any schools adopted it?
So we had a school in Wuppertal in Germany we worked with, but because it was a private school and the people who sponsored the school didn't want to pay anymore and so on, and there were a little bit of conflicts. So that school isn't working with us anymore, so we're trying our best, but it worked pretty well there, so all the teachers were like blown away by our tools, and also the students were very glad to have these tools because it's open source. And currently we are working with a school in Lübeck. It's in the north. It's in the north of Germany, and it's running pretty well.
So, do you have an Android app, or is that just a mobile version of the website?
So we have an Android app for Alexis, and yeah.
Okay, great. What license is it released under?
I think it's so everyone can contribute to this. So it's open source, everyone can contribute, and we're doing this over EduGit because it's an alternative to GitLab. Because as you may know, at GitLab, also miners need to accept certain terms of use. They are not allowed to.
Okay, very good. In fact, I had to get permission from your father to do this interview. So well done, and enjoy the rest of the show.
Thanks.
I'm at the Techno Ethical booth, and I'm talking to
Tiberio Turburano.
So this says Techno Ethical free system compatibility hardware for GNU/Linux, Replicant, and LibreBoot. What does that mean?
Well, what we do, this is a free software oriented project that deals with hardware. Yeah. So what we do is research devices that are compatible with these operating systems and firmware. And then we source them, we refurbish them, we work a great deal on refurbishing. Yeah. We test them very well, and then we sell them to customers that want to use readily available freedom-respecting devices.
So this is 100% free?
This is 100% free operating system devices, but in terms of BIOS or bootloader, only for the computers like desktop computers and laptops, we have the possibility to install free BIOSes. While for the phones, they're still running proprietary bootloader. The main operating system is free software, completely free software, but the bootloader, which is the equivalent to the BIOS, still is proprietary. Or even if we can liberate, we can't liberate all the stages of this proprietary bootloader as of yet. We are working with the community on solving those issues as well.
So this is a technical goal for the future, is to be able to get 100% free. But even going back to the laptop, you're saying every piece of code, once that thing turns on, the whole way through is free software.
That's an overstatement. I want to close on the phones to say that it's impossible for now to have completely free freedom-respecting phone, because we still have to figure out, besides the bootloader, also the Wi-Fi that needs, for now, most of, if not all, of the chips inside the devices, the mobile devices, use proprietary blobs for Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, and GPS, and so on. For the Wi-Fi, we've been able to figure it out how to support external Wi-Fi that we're also selling. On USB, we connected with a device called OTG for being able to use Wi-Fi, connect to Wi-Fi without the need of proprietary blobs, without using the internal one. So we just connect it externally. But that's inconvenient. And for the laptops, we still have some parts that are not free software. For instance, what bothers us is the embedded controller, which is the one that controls the power in the laptop, the keyboard, and so on.
Well, you know, it's a goal. It's a journey. How are the Free Software Foundation thinking about your project?
Well, our project is the one that has the most devices approved by Free Software Foundation under the Respect Your Freedom certification. We also have the newest models certified. This here displayed is the T400S slim version laptop. It has it's built in with an X220 keyboard. This version is also with a display that has finger touch capability. So we're really proud. This is our flagship product.
It's covered in drool from all the people all the engineers going past. So not really, not really. How much is that going for? I hate to ask.
Well, it's around 1,000 euros.
Yeah.
People might ask, be curious why it costs so much for an old laptop. But, well, when you buy a laptop, you have to figure out what is more important for you. It is performance or is it freedom? And for us, freedom is more important. And we work very hard on refurbishing these old devices to look like new. And, you know, be your partner in business and your projects for years to come, not just break in the next year.
Well, I think sometimes you've got to walk the walk. If you want to walk the walk, you got to take out your wallet and talk the talk. And 1,000 euros is not that bad for a freedom-respecting laptop. I'll tell you, though, if you were to do this yourself and sit down and count the amount of time and effort that would be needed to refurbish your laptop and put all the code and do all the debugging, 1,000 is not too far off the mark. I'm really interested in anything that you have in the phone section, even if it's as free as you can possibly get. Can you talk to me about that?
Sure. So we have three phone models supported that we also sell. This is Replicant running on them. The community is very active these days. They have released the version 4 of Replicant 6, and while they are with the security patches updated to 2019, while they are still working in parallel on Replicant 9, based on the latest version of Android. So we are pretty happy about the collaboration with Replicant.
Does that support F-Droid or not?
F-Droid, I think, has been dropped for it because they were not removing some software that they were labeling as problematic in terms of freedom and privacy. And the free software guidelines of the Free Software Foundation and the GNU project recommend that these software applications don't stay in repositories on the same server. Yeah.
Okay. Absolutely excellent. What else have you got on here that you can show me?
Sorry, I didn't get that.
What else have you... you've got a big motherboard here as well. What's special about that?
Well, this is a server board or a workstation board that has a lot of horsepower. It has two AMD processors with 16 core each and up to 128 gig of RAM. It's been the LibreBoot support has been developed by a company that also makes a server board based on open power architecture. And what is our part in all this is that we source, test very well, refurbish the server boards. We complete them with a case and graphics cards that are compatible with free software. We test them and we ship them completely with the Triskel operating system and LibreBoot firmware with sources and instructions on how to modify and flash LibreBoot yourself.
So fantastic. So basically you are the company to go to if you want to buy ethical hardware.
We are proud to be the company that has the largest catalog, so we provide a lot of diversity. If you're interested in freedom-respecting devices, I think it's good for you to stop by and see if you find something interesting.
Okay, well, thank you very much for taking the time and enjoy the rest of the show.
Thank you.
We're standing outside of a conference, and you are?
I am Dead Program, a.k.a. Ron Evans in the real world, but on the internet, I am Dead Program, and I am one of the contributors and maintainers of TinyGo.
What is TinyGo?
TinyGo is a Go compiler that is intended for all the small places, microcontrollers, WebAssembly, all the places where the traditional Go language is too large meaning executable files are too big.
Okay, so why would a program in Go in the first place?
Well, Go is a very appealing language for a number of reasons. One is that it's a very simple language. There's only, I believe, 26 keywords. Also, the reason why people use Go is generally for concurrency programming. It uses a model that's known as CSP, which is created by Tony Hoare. It's basically a way of writing concurrent code in a very simple way using channels. So most people who write Go code, who use the main Go interpreter, or interpretation, that's not an interpreter, but implementation, that's what I mean to say. If you use this main Go implementation, you're using Go because you want to run very efficiently on multi-core machines while using all of the cores. So that's one of like the primary use cases. But the language itself is quite appealing, and its concurrency model is quite appealing. So we thought, why can't we run Go on the smallest of chips, microcontrollers? I mean, if you can run Python or JavaScript on a microcontroller, you certainly should be able to run Go. Well, of course, those are famous first words that start a whole adventure of software development. TinyGo originally is created by my colleague Ike van Lottem, who's a very gifted programmer out of the Netherlands. I discovered the project about a year and a half ago, and I guess I'm like the first crazy dancer. Never mind all those thousands of lines of code I also wrote. That was my alter ego. So TinyGo uses the Go compiler to then compile Go into LLVM. LLVM is a framework for creating compilers, and it's what's being used by a few languages that people might have heard of, like Swift or Rust. So it's a very robust and mature set of tools for building compilers. So we take the Go compiler toolchain, we parse the Go code, and we turn it into what's known as the SSA, or single static assignment form, which is its most reduced form as a language. Then TinyGo takes that and converts it into LLVM intermediate representation, or IR. That's what LLVM uses to then compile for whatever target architecture and process. That's why we can compile our code for even the smallest of microcontrollers, which I think at this point is an ATtiny85. It's an AVR microcontroller that has an 8-bit processor and only 8K of RAM.
So how would that compare to, say, something written in C using the ID given by the...
Well, you know, nobody ever got fired for choosing C to do embedded systems. But let's just say that, you know, C is a language that is definitely showing the stress of being... you know, morphed into way more things than I think it was originally intended to do. You know, of Unix System 5 programming, basically. Sidebar, I have a first edition Kernighan and Ritchie book that I did not buy brand new. It was not used, but it was new, but I didn't buy it when it first came out. Like, you could buy those books new in bookstores for years after it came out. No one cared. You know, it's amazing. You know, now, of course, the world runs on C, you know, if you're talking about embedded systems. Well, but there's a lot of easy mistakes to make in C that have resulted in some fairly spectacular exploits and some really, you know, tragic dysfunction as far as the internet infrastructure we all count on. So, you know, C is a language which I think teaches us some of the next things to do, but, you know, so-called modern programming, modern software engineering involves certain types of practices as well. Things like continuous integration, you know, things like code analysis, easy programming of concurrency, garbage collection. These are all things that it's actually quite hard or maybe even impossible to do in C. So that's where more modern languages like Go, for example, have come along.
But speaking purely from the efficiency of the codes, the ones and zeros running on the microcontrollers, how would they compare an equivalent small program written in C versus...
TinyGo. MicroGo, TinyGo. It's a very, very small Go.
Yeah.
So if we compile our code, that is Go, and we turn off the garbage collector, then we can compile code that is pretty equivalent to the compiled executable size in C. Even turning on the garbage collector, which is one of the main reasons why you want to use Go in the first place, one of my demos I'll be showing in my talk here at FOSDEM tomorrow is I'll be showing on that same ATtiny an 8 8-bit 8K processor, I have a program that will be controlling a bunch of NeoPixel WS2812 lights and an LED. And that program is 768 bytes in size.
Oh, nice. Nice stuff. Thank you very much for the interview, and enjoy the rest of it.
Hey, thanks for talking to me. And everybody, please check out TinyGo.
I'm at the XCP-NG, that's X-Ray Charlie Papa-November Golf booth, and I'm talking to...
Benjamin Morez.
And you are?
And Oliver.
So tell me, what is XCP-NG?
So basically XCP-NG is a virtualization platform, like for example Proxmox or VMware if you aren't in the open source world. And the goal is to deliver something that just works out of the box. So it's a Linux distro, but bundled with Xen inside and a tool stack, an API, and then you can add a web UI called Xen Orchestra on top. And you have a full usable stack out of the box.
And is this just for hobby use or is it used in production?
Okay, so historically it's a fork of Xen Server edited by Citrix, but Citrix decided to remove some features in the free edition, so we were unhappy about that, so we decided to create the project 2 years ago. And since it's used both for home labbers with one machines, but also in production with big players with more than 1,000 hosts. So it's pretty scalable, and it's both used by a lot of different users. And it's completely open source in the way that all the features are accessible directly. There is no paywall or hidden features. And the business model is pretty simple. It's supports only.
Okay, very cool. What sort of licenses is it available under?
So mainly XCP-NG is because of all the components inside. So it's not trivial, but Xen is GPLv2, for example. Xen Orchestra is GPLv3. So we try to get to the... better license as we could, you know, because with AGPL you have more protection, but you can change the license, for example, for Xen, which is an old open source project. But also the thing that we like to do inside XCP-NG project is to contribute to all this project upstream first, because this is the way you can succeed in an open source project.
Fantastic. Okay, thank you, and enjoy the rest of the show. And I'm talking to?
Jaromil.
So, what are you doing here at FOSDEM?
I'm meeting old friends, meeting new friends, and hanging out mostly in, you know, the networking and the community. Because the videos, I can look at them mostly online. So, and yeah, it's a good meeting point. I'm getting a shower of smartness from anyone I talk to. You can literally start any conversation with anyone here. You know, just ask, like, what's the shell that you're using? And you're going to have fun.
What project are you here talking about today?
I use ZSH, by the way. And yes, we are launching a new project, a software, which is free and open source, GPL yes. license. It's called ZenRoom. Yes. It's a virtual machine. Yep. It processes human language. It's ready to process malevolent code expressed in human language. It bails out if this code is not authenticated and executes it if it's authenticated. And execution is about cryptographic transformations. So you can do from basic Diffie-Hellman encryption and signature, AES, you know, FIPS compliant sort of things. And also you can program new cryptographic schemes with a language very similar to Mathematica, which is something I crafted out of Lua. So it's a subset of Lua. I use Lua as syntax, direct syntax parser. And it executes elliptic curve operations that cryptographers are very acquainted with, because it's like Mathematica or similar software. So then you can work with a cryptographer and with an applied cryptographer. I'm an applied cryptographer. In parallel, it becomes a sort of template for cryptographers. And it's useful because you see templating brought a lot of freedom to web development when you can change the code without changing the design, not abstracting those parts. So we're trying to do something like that for cryptography, that cryptographers can express very simply their formula.
So this is purely for the cryptographic community.
Yes.
Like a normal human isn't going to be using this, are they?
Yeah, we want lawyers to be able to read code. Because, you know, in Europe we had the GDPR, the General Directive Data Protection Regulation. Thank you. And so that creates a liability in most organizations in terms of a data protection officer. And often these people are responsible, they are senior, let's say, in their organization, but they don't come from programming, and they have to activate, in order to verify, really, they have to activate a whole department of ICT just to understand what's going on. That's a huge overhead, and actually also a huge responsibility. So we want, and also, at least, I mean, where we researched a little bit in Italy, France, Netherlands, most of these figures are lawyers or people that know the law, that are able actually to play the bridge between the law and the code. So why not making that closer together? Because we want to facilitate these people to verify the systems that they need to. And, so we're writing...
How is encryption going to help that?
Encryption is what you need to do, like, classifying certain documents, signing them, spreading them, making a shared key to access a certain lock. So that... serves this sort of purposes. It's an architecture. You can build architectures of trust with encryption. Then, on the other side, what we do is putting a human language inspired to behavioral-driven development. So it's a sort of prologue. It's non-Turing complete. And it's very secure. It can accept malevolent code. So, yeah, that's the other part that we add to the possibilities that cryptography gives you.
Okay. Your website's zenroom.org?
Yes, and our organization is dyne.org.
Yeah.
It's a foundation based in Amsterdam.
Yes, so I am familiar with the project, yes.
Cheers.
Thank you very much, and enjoy the rest of the show.
Thank you.
Take it from me with no manipulation. Sign up. You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HBR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.